This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. On Monday, General Motors hit the brakes. The American car manufacturer announced plans to cut more than 14,000 jobs and halt production at 5 plants across the U.S. and Canada. The pain of the announcement was felt from Detroit, Michigan.
It's an extremely disappointing decision. We moved thousands of people, hundreds of businesses, to create that assembly plant.
To Lordstown, Ohio.
Right before the holidays, you hate to see people get news like this, but this isn't just a GM local issue. It's an issue across the board with any auto manufacturer right now.
All the way up to Oshawa, Ontario, just north of Toronto, where workers walked off the job.
They are not closing our damn plant without one hell of a fight.
President Trump, who's promised repeatedly to bring these kinds of manufacturing jobs back, wasn't happy about the change either.
You know, this country's done a lot for General Motors. You better get back in there soon. That's Ohio. And you better get back in there soon. So we have a lot of pressure on them. You have senators. You have a lot of other people. A lot of pressure. They say the Chevy Cruze is not selling well. I say, well, then get a car that is selling well and put it back in.
But it's not that simple. Automotive News predicts that in 2018, U.S. car sales could fall below 17 million vehicles for the first time in 4 years. General Motors referred to the layoffs and closures as a restructuring. So, where does that leave the American auto industry? I'm putting that question to Bill Koenig, senior editor of Manufacturing Engineering Magazine. Bill is joining us from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Great to be here.
So GM is calling this a quote-unquote restructuring. You're someone who's covered this industry for a long time. When you hear the word restructuring in the auto industry, are you hearing layoffs and cost-cutting or innovation?
I usually think job cuts and plant closings because they inevitably accompany restructurings. It's a bit more polite way of saying it. But there is a broader thing going on. Right now, the auto industry is at the cusp of the biggest change in more than a century. What happened a century ago was it was sort of a toss-up. Which one would win out? Would it be the mass-produced cars or would it be the hand-built cars like the Cords and the Duesenbergs? Well, the mass-produced cars won out. What we're looking at now is there may be a shift to self-driving vehicles, ride-sharing services, and things that would have very fundamental changes. And nobody really knows how it's going to play out. And so what GM is doing and other automakers are looking to do is essentially, you know, trucks are still very popular. That's how they finance their investments in this future technology. And, you know, the market has shifted away from cars. So essentially, GM is cutting way back in cars. Ford has already said it's going to cut way back in cars. So what they're doing is they're trying to amp up the profits from the trucks to pay for the self-driving vehicles and the future stuff.
So I was going to say, how much of this has to do with American car sales and preferences changing versus the Trump tariffs, for example?
Definitely the shift toward away from cars is definitely a factor. If car sales were stronger than they are, you still might have a restructuring, but it wouldn't take this form.
And I'm wondering, what is this, you know, in terms of the what led to this? I mean, we had heard that there were several plants that had issues between management and union workers. Was any of this exacerbated by labor issues?
All three of the assembly plants, there's also two engine plants that were affected by yesterday's announcement, but all three of those assembly plants have had problematical issues over the years. GM has tried to close Oshawa before, and it managed to win a reprieve, but it has tough labor relations. Lordstown has had terrible labor relations over decades. And Detroit Hamtramck, I'm not sure it was ever worth the investment. It's never like boomed the way other plants do. I'm not saying it's the primary reason by any means, but You got to take it into consideration.
It feels like there's a situation. We've been trying to, quote unquote, save the auto industry for years now. And it just feels like maybe, in your estimation, are we trying to save something that's just never going to really be saved at this point?
Well, I think there'll still be an auto industry, but it may be greatly changed. essentially, what GM's trying to do is stay ahead of the curve. They don't want to be in a position like they were 10 years ago. So, you know, they're saying we have to do this for the future. We'll see.
Bill Koenig is senior editor of Manufacturing Engineering. Bill, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Sarah calling from Lansing, Michigan. It used to be that everyone here had someone they knew or more than one person who worked for GM, but now we all used to know someone who did. It's not like it used to be. There's no careers there anymore.
My name is Pat. I'm calling from Southern California. I grew up in Los Angeles, and we made cars here when I was a kid and into my early adulthood. We are the epicenter of car culture. Even all the auto manufacturers have their design studios here. And then all of the auto plants left Southern California. And soon after, all of the raceways and drag strips left. And now custom car culture here is kind of dead.
Hi, my name is Kathy, calling from Fort Lauderdale. I grew up and lived in the Detroit area most of my life. Lots of unemployment, not only at the big three, but also at Lear, American Axle, and any other things tied to the car industry. Also, people that are being hired come in through temp agencies with low pay and no benefits and are not hired directly by the companies in many cases. People can't build a future that way. A sad commentary on the times. Give people a decent wage and a pension. CEOs and shareholders take it all.
Detroit, the site of General Motors headquarters, will face the brunt of Monday's changes. Two factories in the Detroit area will halt production next year. More than 1,500 workers are employed at the assembly plant on the border of Detroit and Hamtramck alone. Karen Majewski has been the mayor of Hamtramck since 2006, and she joins me now. Mayor Majewski, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
So what is Hamtramck like?
Well, Hamtramck is kind of an old school ethnic urban neighborhood. We're just 2 square miles with 25,000 people. So we're the most densely populated city in the state. And it really is an old school ethnic urban working class neighborhood. We're also the most internationally diverse city in the state. We have more than 26 languages spoken in our schools in just 2 square miles.
And how did the Detroit Hamtramck Assembly happen? What's the story? What's the history of the plant in your town?
The Detroit Hamtramck Assembly Plant really has a interesting and somewhat troubled history. The plant was built on land that was taken by eminent domain in the early 1980s. The land on which the plant stands had been a thriving neighborhood, much like Hamtramck. And all of that land was seized by eminent domain, by GM, and bulldozed, basically completely leveled to build that plant. So thousands and thousands of families and businesses were displaced to build that plant in the early 1980s under the promise that the city needed the economic boost and that this was for the common good. Now we see 40 years later that those families and those businesses and those individuals who made that sacrifice are, you know, now looking at a vacant manufacturing facility in place of you know, what was once a thriving neighborhood.
Are many of the people who live in Hamtramck also working in GM or in the auto industry more broadly?
You know, that's hard to say. We know that relatively few of the workers in the plant itself are Hamtramck residents. It's easy on, you know, easy access to the expressway. So, you know, most folks probably live in the suburbs.
So what impact do you think this would have on the community? If it's not workers directly, how would it impact Hamtramck?
Well, there are a number of impacts. I mean, one, of course, is economic. You know, although relatively few of the workers live in Hamtramck, there are still some who do. And we, of course, get income taxes from them as well as their, you know, as their input into the community itself as residents. But we also get tax revenue from property tax and other revenue from the plant itself. That's a significant part of our budget. I think that from the city's perspective, we just have to look at what in practical terms we can do in conversations with the company and of course with our neighboring city, with Detroit, with the county, with the state, to look at what we can do to survive. I mean, at this point, we're really talking about survival for a small city like Hamtramck.
Mayor, if that land or that property remains vacant, what's the long-term impact for the residents there in Hamtramck?
Well, if nothing is done with that land, if it's simply, or that property, if it's simply allowed to deteriorate or simply boarded up, that has enormous impact for us financially. Of course, you know, the loss of tax revenue, and that would have to be negotiated with the company, but also the perception of decline and disinvestment hurts other potential projects for us. It hurts our reputation as a city, as a viable place to live and do business. So the implications really, you know, go beyond the bottom line, you know, financial loss of tax revenue or something like that. It really does have to do with perception, with our identity as a city. You know, Hamtramck was created around the auto industry. In 1910, the Dodge brothers came in and they built the Dodge main plant, and Hamtramck became the fastest growing city in the country. And suddenly overnight, tens of thousands of immigrants poured in for jobs in the auto industry. And Hamtramck was born, essentially. And that's been part of our identity through the ups and downs of the auto industry and of manufacturing. That's been our identity ever since. And this plant is the last remaining auto plant in the city. So it's the last kind of vestige of our history as a manufacturing center. In a way, there's that to consider, too, is kind of a psychic blow or a kind of cultural blow, which, you know, may have an upside as well. I mean, of course, we all have to be thinking as manufacturing declines or changes in the country, we all have to be thinking about, you know, who we are as a nation, what it is that we do, what we make, and how we make it, and who makes it, and on what kind of scale it's made.
Karen Majewski is the mayor of Hamtramck. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Just days ahead of the G20 summit, when leaders from the world's leading economies will meet in Argentina, tensions are high between Ukraine and Russia. On Sunday, the Russian Coast Guard fired on and seized three Ukrainian military vessels and 23 sailors in the Kerch Strait, which separates Crimea from the Russian mainland. On Monday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo called on Russia to return to Ukraine its vessels and detained crew members. Both Russia and Ukraine called for an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council yesterday, where Nikki Haley had this to say.
In May, the United States condemned Russia's construction and opening of the Kerch Strait Bridge between Russia and occupied Crimea. In August, the United States condemned Russia's harassment of international shipping in the Sea of Azov and the Kerch Strait. The United States will continue to stand with the people of Ukraine against the Russian aggression.
Joining us now is Christopher Miller, a correspondent for Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty in Ukraine. He joins us now from Kiev. Christopher, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So we just heard Nikki Haley's condemnation of these acts, but beyond the rhetoric, how is the U.S. and the rest of the international community responding to this latest development?
Well, it's interesting that you played Nikki Haley first, because she was the most senior Washington official, or U.S. official, rather, to speak out against what is perceived as Russia's aggression against Ukraine. But most of the, well, certainly the quickest statements of condemnation that we heard came from Ukraine's allies in Europe and Canada as well. Europe, I think, has been much more on point in the last couple of years in terms of speaking out strongly and quickly when it comes to Russia's aggression against Ukraine in eastern Ukraine as well as in Crimea.
And are we really looking at, will Russia face any repercussions for this? I mean, like we mentioned, the G20 is a couple days away. Are we thinking about sanctions at this point? What could the penalties be?
Ukraine is certainly hoping that there will be more and stronger sanctions from the U.S. in particular, as well as the EU. We'll have a better sense of whether there are any new sanctions coming down the pike, probably after that G20 meeting. I know that right now this is something that is being mulled in Brussels, but I haven't heard any specifics on what types of sanctions could be imposed. You know, there already have been a slate of sanctions imposed against Russia for the annexation of Crimea and its aggression against Ukraine in eastern Ukraine. But, you know, one of the things that Ukraine has repeatedly asked for are stronger sanctions. We heard actually Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov yesterday in the wake of the skirmish in the Black Sea near the Kerch Strait saying, I'll paraphrase, but he said, you know, sanctions, we don't fear sanctions anymore. You know, so that gives you a sense of just how Russia feels as though it can operate with impunity and continue these sort of attacks against Ukraine.
Another thing that we have to keep in mind here is that President Trump is expected to meet with President Putin. Their relationship, as far as the president defines it, is a good one. Will that hurt any attempt at sanctions?
It'll be interesting to see what comes out of that meeting. You know, President Trump has not been particularly strong in his messaging when it comes to Russia's military aggression against Ukraine. You know, his comments yesterday were pretty wishy-washy. He suggested that perhaps both sides might be at fault to some extent. That conflicts with the stronger statements that are coming from Nikki Haley, as we mentioned earlier, and the State Department later on. It'll be interesting to see what does come out of that G20 summit. I don't know whether or not we'll find out many of the details of that meeting. If you look at the Helsinki meeting over the summer, you know, there's a lot that we still don't know about what was discussed between President Trump and President Putin in their one-on-one before their press conference.
Feels like years ago that meeting happened, Christopher. Is Russia posturing here, or is this a real provocation that could lead to deepening conflict and potentially war?
You know, it could be a little of both. You know, Russia has taken similar aggressive steps over the course of more than 4.5 years now when it comes to Ukraine. I think this is yet another test for the international community, right? It just keeps kind of, you know, either taking more ground or attacking in some new way, opening up a new front here in this case. And, you know, at each step of the way, while there have been some sanctions and strong condemnations, you know, I think they feel as though they're able to operate with a certain level of impunity, right? Like I said earlier, you know, Sergei Lavrov's message yesterday didn't really give the sense that Russia was really shaking.
And obviously, this is the latest escalation in a nearly 5-year-long conflict. What's the situation been like in the area recently?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time in the in eastern Ukraine and going back and forth to and from Kiev. You know, right now in Kiev, things are tense just because of this skirmish. But more or less on a daily basis, you know, people here come and go to work more or less regularly and not thinking, you know, too much about the conflict until there's a flare up. Right. There'll be a report of 5 dead soldiers or another handful of civilians killed, you know, from an artillery barrage. But, you know, you go out to eastern Ukraine and, you know, people still live very much on edge. You know, in some cases, water has been knocked out, power has been knocked out. The temperatures have already, for several weeks now, been below freezing. The humanitarian situation is particularly dire. And while the conflict is more or less simmering on a daily basis and not as hot as it was in 2014 and 2015, you know, there are still artillery duels on an almost daily basis. There are, on average, I think, around 2 or 3 soldiers that are killed every 2 or 3 days. Not a week goes by that we don't hear about a death.
And what about Ukrainian President Poroshenko? He's up for re-election in March. What does this tell us about him? They have obviously imposed martial law within Ukraine's borders.
That's right. So martial law is set to be imposed tomorrow at 9 a.m. local time, and it's going to cover 10 regions. Within these regions, the government will have greater powers while restricting things like the media, public gatherings, freedom of movement. There will be tighter border controls. These are areas that border Russia or border Crimea or border the breakaway territory in Moldova where Russia has troops. And yes, Poroshenko is up for re-election, and these elections are slated for March 31st. And actually, that was a big issue in getting the martial law decree passed in parliament yesterday. A lot of people saw this as a political move by Poroshenko, who is doing not very well in the polls. And the one thing that Ukrainians do praise him for is rebuilding the country's military and for being a strong commander in chief. And so, you know, one of the things that people are critical of here is his ability to use that and potentially use this situation for personal political gain.
Christopher Miller is a correspondent for Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty in Ukraine. Christopher, thank you again for your reporting.
Thank you.
Go to omahasteaks.com and enter code TAKEAWAY into the search bar to get 74% off Omaha Steaks Family Gift Package, now only $49.99. Order now and you'll get 4 hand-cut age-to-tenderness top sirloin steaks, 2 savory premium pork chops, 4 chicken fried steaks, 4 Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, 4 perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, 4 made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, plus get 4 more burgers for free. Again, just go to omahasteaks.com, type takeaway into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait. Order today.
For you podcast listeners out there, you may know Earlonne Woods as the host of a revolutionary podcast, Ear Hustle. It's a podcast that tells the stories of inmates at the San Quentin State Prison. And it's remarkable because it's told from the inside. This Thanksgiving, Earlonne had something to be especially thankful for.
After 21 years in prison, Governor Brown, the great governor of California,
absolutely,
decided that I served enough time in California State Prison, and he commuted my sentence to be released forthwith, immediately, right now. It's time to go.
Time for E to walk out that gate.
Time to walk out that gate.
Earlonne was sentenced to 31 years to life for attempted second-degree robbery. He was serving his time at the San Quentin State Prison. And here's Earlonne calling his mother to tell her the news that his sentence had been commuted.
Hey, Mama, it finally came. They commuted my sentence today. So that
means...
Yes, that means
you're... Oh, my God, I get to have a man around the house.
Oh, sadly, I'm not coming back to sit down south. No.
No,
I paroled to Oakland, but I'll be down there, but I paroled to Oakland.
Oh, well, I'll be in Oakland.
Yes. So,
Uncle's coming home.
Joining us to discuss the podcast and what comes next for Earlonne Woods is Nigel Poor, co-host and producer of Ear Hustle. Nigel, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
This is so exciting. Incredible news. Tell us the moment when he first found out, when Earlonne first found out that his sentence would be commuted.
Well, it's been a long process. He's been working on it for almost a year. So, you know, there's been a lot of waiting and kind of false hopes and stuff. But I can tell you about the moment he got the phone call where he knew it was actually going to happen. We were down in the media lab working on our next episode, and we heard the phone ring, and when his name was called, we knew it was only for one reason, which was that the governor's office was calling him to give him the news. And there was a huge shout of joy that went up in the media lab, lots of excitement. And then Earlonne and I scrambling to get the portable recorder ready so we could record the process.
What was your reaction? You've been working with Earlonne for quite some time. I mean, how did you feel about his sentence being commuted?
It was just amazing. And actually just hearing you play that tape brings it all back, hearing the excitement in his voice, hearing his mother. You know, it's a kind of excitement and pleasure that's really hard to describe because it seemed so impossible for a long time that his sentence would actually change. So, I mean, but we've been doing a lot of things that are seemingly impossible. So we had a lot of hope and we've got a lot of excitement about the future and what it's going to bring for Earlonne and what it's going to bring for Ear Hustle.
You guys did an episode of the podcast called So Long, and you did exit interviews with people who are about to get out of prison. And we really learned from this episode some of the challenges that people say they're going to face on the outside. And here's Earlonne talking about some of those challenges.
What do you think are some of the most difficult challenges they are going to face out there?
If they don't have housing,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Employment,
Because a lot of times you're supposed to get a job before you get out.
Right.
You know, and it's impossible. But you may know somebody that knows somebody to say, I'll give them a shot. So I think that is going to be tough for guys.
There's definitely going to be challenges. But fingers crossed.
No fingers crossed. These guys are going to survive. They're going to make it.
So we've talked a lot on this show and just in terms of criminal justice reform, generally speaking, that these are real concerns. There are housing limitations. There are employment limitations, depending on where you are. So what's the reality that's waiting for Earlon on the other side?
Well, Earlon is in, I think, a much better situation than most people. So we work with PRX and Radiotopia. They produce our podcast, and they'll be hiring Earlon when he gets out of prison to continue to work on Ear Hustle. So he has a great job waiting for him. He also has housing that's been set up by a really great organization called Restore. So he's set. But I can't say that's the case for a lot of people who get out. I mean, finding a job, as he said, is incredibly difficult. Finding housing, especially in the Bay Area, is a challenge. So I'm really happy for Earlon. But of course, we, you know, both of us think about what will happen for other people who get out. And in fact, as we move forward with Ear Hustle, that's one of the areas we're really going to talk about, is what is the reentry process like for most people and what are the challenges and the everyday stories of that.
I want to ask you about the future of Ear Hustle in just a second. Mm-hmm. But interestingly, in that same episode we just played a clip from, Earlon and you were talking about how much movement there's been at San Quentin. And it seems like there are lots of people getting out earlier than they expected. We know that Governor Jerry Brown has granted more pardons in California than any governor since the 1940s. Are you seeing real changes in sentencing laws and a more of an increased effort to get people out of these sentences that just seem endless?
Well, I am not a policy person, so what I have to say is just anecdotal. I haven't necessarily seen a change in the sentencing laws, but there has been quite an exodus of people from San Quentin, you know, specifically from San Quentin, with Jerry Brown doing the commutations. We worked down in the media lab, and there's been so many men over the last year who have been getting out. So it does feel like a change. I don't know if it's a policy change, but I do believe that, you know, obviously it's clear Governor Brown is commuting a lot of people.
I want to talk a little bit about San Quentin itself. I've reported in a jail before. It's not easy to get access to these spaces, particularly to set up an entire podcast and have it go for this long. What was that process like to get San Quentin to agree to do this?
Yes, we always want to make clear that San Quentin is very different from other prisons. There's so many programs that happen in there. So the administration is comfortable with people coming in and out. And I was volunteering inside the prison for quite a few years before we started the podcast. And, you know, I made it my business to get to know people and get support of the administration. And Lieutenant Sam Robinson, who is the public information officer there, is incredibly supportive of these various programs, and without him, we couldn't do it. But I always tell people that it takes three P's to work in prison, and that's patience, politeness, and persistence. And without those three things, you're not going to survive there, because you aren't necessarily anyone's priority. You know, you have to make things happen on someone else's schedule. And we've just been really determined to do this and made kind of our dream come true in there. But I don't know how easy it would be inside of other institutions.
I'm curious also with the host, at least the co-host, going on to this next chapter in his life, what happens inside San Quentin with Ear Hustle? Is there someone else who might want to take over? Are there other folks who are interested in working on the podcast and doing other podcasts perhaps?
Yes. So we went through a hiring process, and we have a new co-host that will be coming on to work with me inside the prison. And Earlon and I will continue to work together doing reentry stories. So Ear Hustle will be changing direction, but it will definitely be continuing with new people, but Earlon also staying on.
Nigel Poor is the co-host and producer of the podcast Ear Hustle. Her co-host, Earlon Woods, served 21 years inside San Quentin State Prison, and last week, his sentence was commuted by California Governor Jerry Brown. Nigel, thanks so much, and best of luck with the new show.
Thank you.
His name is Emantic Fitzgerald Bradford Jr., or EJ, a 21-year-old black man who was shot and killed by police in Alabama last week. On Thanksgiving night, police in Hoover, Alabama, were responding to a shooting at a local mall that left two people injured. When they arrived, an officer shot Bradford in the face, killing him. Hoover Police Chief Nick Dervis initially told AL.com that his officers, quote, heard the gunfire, they engaged the subject, and they took out the threat. But they were wrong. Hoover Police later issued a statement saying Bradford, quote, likely did not fire the rounds, and that at least one suspect was still at large. Protests like the one you heard a moment ago began over the weekend and continued through the night. Janae Pierre is a reporter for WBHM in Birmingham and has been following this story closely. Janae, thanks for being with us on The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So we've heard two different statements from the police. Where do we stand now?
Well, we're still in the same place, Tanzina. So the shooter is still at large. No video evidence has been released, although we know that video evidence does exist. The case is being handled by the state's top law enforcement agency. And questions still remain unanswered at this point.
In the latest statement, the police also said that EJ was armed, and I'm quoting here from their statement. They said it, quote, heightened the sense of threat to approaching police officers. What do we make of that? Isn't Alabama an open carry state, and wasn't EJ a registered gun owner?
Yes and yes. Alabama is an open carry state. It was totally fine that he had the gun. It was said in the statement that EJ was brandishing a gun, and that may be what heightened the situation, and that's what caused the uniform officer, to shoot and kill EJ.
And yet, there are some witness reports that are saying that more than one person grabbed their weapon when they heard shots. I mean, isn't that something that you would almost expect, sadly, in a place where people can carry their guns openly?
Yeah, I mean, if somebody heard gunshots, I think it's only natural that you grab your weapon because you have and own that weapon because you're trying to protect yourself. I just don't understand exactly why EJ was targeted. Many people are saying that it is because he was a black man brandishing a gun. We know now that he was not the guy who shot the 18-year-old who was wounded. And like I said earlier, that guy is or woman is still at large.
You know, in this case has got me thinking on a lot of us thinking about Jamel Roberson, who was the black security guard who stopped a bar shootout, but was also killed by police who responded to the scene. Do you see any similarities in these two cases?
You know, I do, and it's far beyond the case of them being black men. However, we have to question, you know, is it okay for a black man to have a weapon? We know that this has happened time after time, and we see it often. That's why the family has retained attorney Ben Crump to handle the case, because he is so familiar with situations like this one.
I mean, often we hear the NRA specifically talking about being the good guy with the gun. I'm wondering if that was the case. Has the NRA made any statement about this?
I haven't heard any statements from the NRA on this particular case. I'm sure that maybe we will, maybe we won't. We're still actually waiting to hear another statement from the mayor of Hoover. Like I said, a lot of questions are unanswered at this point. Protesters are demanding justice. There was another protest here in the area last night. Protesters began at the Hoover Police Department. They actually kind of shut down Highway 31, which is on the path to the mall, and they marched all the way to the mall, into the mall once again to protest and demand justice for EJ Bradford.
Janae Pierre is a reporter for WBHM in Birmingham. Janae, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Today, the U.S. Supreme Court will begin hearing arguments in Carpenter v. Murphy. It's a case that could dramatically expand the boundaries of the Muscogee Creek Nation in Oklahoma. The case centers around a 1999 murder committed by Patrick Murphy, a Muscogee Creek citizen. The state of Oklahoma sentenced Murphy to death, but Murphy's lawyers challenged the state's jurisdiction, saying that only the federal government had the authority to prosecute crimes that take place on tribal reservations. Now, the nation's highest court will determine whether almost half of the state of Oklahoma is technically reservation land. To help break down the case, I spoke with two people who have been following it closely. Sterling Cosper is a former manager of Muskogee Media, and he's now a freelance Muskogee Creek journalist. And Mary Catherine Nagel is a partner at Pipestem Law, a firm specializing in tribal sovereignty of Native nations and peoples.
The case has been made into many different issues by many different parties with different interests, but ultimately, the question is whether or not courts can judicially disestablish reservations that Congress never has. The Supreme Court precedent on point since a case called Celestine in 1909 has been that once Congress establishes a reservation, only Congress can disestablish that reservation and say it no longer exists.
I want to clarify there. What does it mean to disestablish a nation?
Well, unfortunately, several tribes have had their reservations disestablished. For instance, the Ponca tribe, the Oto Missouria tribe in Oklahoma, Congress passed specific legislation saying the reservation you previously had is now hereby abolished. I think many advocates for tribal sovereignty and for tribal nations and tribal citizens would say that that's, problematic, right? But at the end of the day, that's the legal framework Congress and the Supreme Court have created for the last 100 years or so. And so essentially what Oklahoma is arguing for here is an overturn of more than 100 years of precedent that only Congress can disestablish an Indian reservation once it's been established.
Now, just for another point of clarity here, if it's disestablished, if you will, and then a crime occurs on a reservation, how is it supposed to be prosecuted? Is it then prosecuted as a crime that's happening within the U.S. federal system or state system, or does it still get prosecuted by Native juries and judges?
Well, this is a really great question because one of Oklahoma's main arguments is that if the Supreme Court decides that the reservation has, in fact, not been disestablished, then there's going to be, chaos and a huge crisis because all of a sudden thousands or hundreds of thousands of American citizens will be subject to tribal criminal jurisdiction. But if you look at the framework the Supreme Court and Congress have created, who has criminal jurisdiction over a crime committed within the borders of a reservation is incredibly complicated, and it's not made less complicated by saying the reservation has been disestablished. So Oklahoma's point, actually, I think, would be served only by saying the reservation hasn't been disestablished. Because if this court were to say it has been disestablished, then any time a crime is committed within the borders of the former, now former reservation, because the court has disestablished it, there'd be questions about the status of the land. Is the land still in allotment? And that is actually incredibly complicated.
Sterling, I want to bring you in here. In this particular case, how do you explain how the Muskogee land is currently categorized by the state of Oklahoma? And why did they think in this case they could persecute the case? Has that land been disestablished?
Right now, people have been operating a lot like she was pointing out, allotment. So it's parcels of land that are tribal land. This case would firmly establish, well, are the 11 to 12 counties within our jurisdiction actually wholly our jurisdiction? So my understanding is that that particular crime may have been committed on what people have been assuming for a long time is Oklahoma land rather than one of those allotments, those parcels of land that were part of basically an effort to dissolve the tribal jurisdiction slowly. And that's where I think a lot of this case kind of centers around is how tribal land has been handled in Oklahoma for so long.
And what about the residents of the reservation? What about the Muskogee Nation? Are they, what's the response been there?
Well, a lot of it for us has been just an education process to explain, the very big implications of this case. And also what it really means, the complexities that maybe people that are listening to this interview are starting to figure out, what is tribal land, what is state land. And the other thing is even once this maybe is decided as a reservation, the tribe doesn't have criminal jurisdiction over non-natives except for in instances of sexual and domestic violence because of the Violence Against Women Act. And so this is only going to be a criminal jurisdiction establishment over Native Americans.
Mary Catherine, I want to bring you in here for a second. Something that Sterling just mentioned was prosecuting of non-natives and because of the Violence Against Women Act. What are the implications of the loss of reservation status for Native women specifically? Could you give us some more detail onto that?
Yeah, well, it's huge in part because in 1978, the United States Supreme Court in Oliphant declared tribal nations no longer able to exercise their inherent criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians who come onto tribal lands and commit crimes. But in 2013, when Congress reauthorized the Violence Against Women Act, Congress restored tribal criminal jurisdiction over three categories of crimes, of non-Indian crimes, specifically dating violence, domestic violence, and violation of protection orders. Of course, the catch here is that when Congress restored this portion of tribes' criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians, they limited it to crimes committed, quote, in Indian country. And again, that is the same statute that's at issue here in this case in Murphy, and that's 18 U.S.C. 1152. And an Indian country is defined as three things: a reservation, allotment land, and a dependent Indian community, which, you know, if the Creek Nation no longer has a reservation under 1152, then VAWA, the restored tribal criminal jurisdiction that Muscogee Creek Nation has implemented, only applies if those crimes are committed on allotted land. So that would mean if a Muscogee Creek woman within the borders of her reservation is being physically or sexually abused by her spouse, her non-Indian spouse, or her dating partner, if she calls the tribal police and says, help, he's beating me, or whatever the crime is or whatever the problem is, whether or not the tribal police will have jurisdiction to help her will be dependent upon the status of the land that she's literally standing on at that time. And so for many tribes across the United States, including Creek Nation, but pretty much all tribes that have had allotment, this puts Native women in a very perilous situation. And the only way to avoid that, of course, is to maintain the current status of the Creek Nation Reservation, which is a reservation that's never been disestablished.
Mary Catherine Nagel is a partner at Pipestem Law, a firm specializing in tribal sovereignty of Native nations and peoples, and a citizen of Cherokee Nation. Mary Catherine, thank you.
Thank you.
And Sterling Cosper is a former manager of Muscogee Media, and he's now a freelance Muscogee Creek journalist. Sterling, thanks again.
Well, thank you.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.